From Pacifica Radio, this is Democracy Now!
Yet ultimately, the ethics of American business depend on the conscience of America's business leaders. We need men and women of character who know the difference between ambition and destructive greed, between justified risk and irresponsibility, between enterprise and fraud.
In a Wall Street address, President Bush says it's corporate executives, not the system, that has to change. This as his own business practices come under scrutiny. Today, we'll have a discussion with former WorldCom and Enron employees, scholars, and corporate crime watchers. Then, protesters in Barcelona, Spain, storm the stage and shout down U.S. Secretary of Health and Human Services Tommy Thompson at the 14th International Conference on AIDS.
Clearly today the message was Tommy Thompson is lying to the community at large, and we're here to tell the true story. For anyone who wants...
All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. As public outrage mounts, various law enforcement agencies in California have opened investigations into the arrest of a teenager who was videotaped being slammed onto a police car and punched in the face while he was handcuffed. Dozens of angry protesters descended on Inglewood City Hall Tuesday, demanding an end to police brutality and the ouster of Officer Jeremy Morse. Inglewood Mayor Roosevelt Dorn responded by saying the officer should be fired and charged with assault. Meanwhile, lawyers for 16-year-old Donovan Jackson and his father plan to announce their intent to file a lawsuit today at the federal courthouse in downtown Los Angeles. The FBI says it's opening a civil rights investigation. The Inglewood Police Department, the Los Angeles County Sheriff, and District Attorney are also investigating. Morse is a 3-year veteran who was put on leave Monday with pay. He could not be reached for comment. Phone messages left for the president of the Inglewood Police Officers Association were not immediately returned. The incident occurred during a weekend traffic stop just east of the Los Angeles International Airport. A tourist videotape showed Morse hoisting Jackson to his feet, throwing his body onto a car, then striking him in the face with a closed fist. Two other officers appear to intervene. Police and sheriff's officials said the teen lunged at deputies and was combative, while the boy's father said his son cooperated and Morse attacked him unprovoked. The family's lawyer said the teen is developmentally disabled with no arrest record. The video was recorded by a man who was staying at a motel across the street. Here in New York, hundreds of people whose loved ones died in the World Trade Center could sue the Port Authority of New York and New Jersey. Some claim the Trade Center's owner blocked potential escape routes and wrongly told people to stay put. New York law requires lawsuits against the Port Authority to be filed within a year of the incident, prompting the litigation. In Washington, the Senate gave President Bush the green light Tuesday to proceed with the Yucca Mountain proposed nuclear waste dump in Nevada. The administration wants to entomb 77,000 tons of highly radioactive materials, most of it building up at power plants in 31 states. The Senate voted to override Nevada's veto of the project following action by the House in May. Under a 1982 law, Nevada could have killed the project if Congress hadn't intervened. In Las Vegas, Nevada Governor Kenny Gwynn promised to pursue at least 5 lawsuits the state has filed challenging the Yucca project. And this news on the front page of the Washington Post today: in a highly unusual airlift involving hundreds of U.S. immigration officers, the Justice Department secretly chartered a Portuguese jet to deport 131 Pakistani detainees who had been held for months at INS detention facilities around the country. A majority of the detainees, a Pakistani official said, had been arrested under a Justice Department program to locate and apprehend immigrants who have ignored previous deportation orders and who came under scrutiny after the September 11th attacks. U.S. officials said none of the detainees appeared to have links to terrorism. Meanwhile, this news from New Jersey. New Jersey highest court has refused to consider compelling the U.S. government to identify people detained in the state after the September 11th attacks, handing a victory to the U.S. policy of keeping the identities secret. This news from Jakarta. With dozens of his soldiers looking on, a senior Indonesian general went on trial Wednesday on charges of allowing the violence that left East Timor in ruins in 1999. Major General Adam Demiri, who was in charge of East Timor, is the highest-ranking military official indicted over the rampage by Indonesian troops and their militia proxies, in which at least 1,000 East Timorese were killed. Human rights groups have dismissed the trials as a whitewash, saying their purpose is to deflect criticism and prevent the United Nations from creating an international war crimes tribunal for East Timor, similar to those for ex-Yugoslavia and Rwanda. And this news, Evo Morales, an upstart Bolivian politician and indigenous leader who vows to end Washington-backed efforts to eradicate drug crops, will contend for the presidency after finishing second in the country's national election. After 10 days of counting votes since the June 30th election, Morales was second. And finally, here in this country, we go to Columbus, Georgia. 37 human rights activists appeared in federal court this week to stand trial for protesting at the U.S. Army School of the Americas in Columbus, Georgia. The school offers combat and counterinsurgency training to Latin American officers. Critics say its graduates have been found guilty of human rights abuses. 10,000 people gathered last November at the gates of Fort Benning in protest. The defendants peacefully entered the grounds of Fort Benning and face up to 6 months in prison and $5,000 in fines if convicted of trespassing. Shannon McManaman joins us right now. She is one of those who went on trial. Welcome to Democracy Now!
Good morning.
Can you tell us what happened in the courtroom?
Yeah, in the past 2 days in the courtroom, we've heard really moving statements from over two dozen of the 37 people who've appeared before the judge. And they've shared their journeys, ranging from witnessing the devastation in Colombia that's being caused by our fumigation and by our training there, to working with torture survivors from El Salvador and Guatemala, to people's personal experiences such as the murder of a mother or their military experience that moved them to believe that this kind of training is wrong. And so people really have explained why they were willing to risk jail and criminal records to do this. Other people talked, such as myself, talked about the realization that the work we do in our communities, for instance, I worked with my union, in my church, and other various peace and justice organizations, that these very simple actions working for democracy and for human rights would make us targets for torture or assassination or disappearance in Colombia today or in El Salvador 15 years ago.
What did the judge rule?
The judge so far has ruled on, there were eight people who pled guilty, and the judge has ruled on 11 of the cases so far. In 10 of those cases, the people were found guilty. In one of the cases, the woman, Lisa Hughes, was found not guilty because she did not walk around the fence that the Army had put up at the base, and she knelt and prayed rather than processing as the charge stated. And this morning, 10 more people, actually right now, are going to have their sentences handed down.
I want to thank you for being with us, Shannon McManaman, speaking to us from Columbus, Georgia. You are listening to Democracy Now!
The sun is shining down, and everybody's happy. Bathing in the waters of denial. My job is so secure, and my government is stable. The weather's getting better, a little warmer every year. Now we've got free trade, and everyone will prosper. The locals here are happy. I think I'll have another beer. Let's go swimming now. We're swimming in the big Egyptian river, bathing in the waters of the Nile. The sun is shining down.
Swimming in the big. Dana Lyons here on Democracy Now! Resistance Radio. I'm Amy Goodman. President Bush stood before an elite corps of Wall Street executives yesterday and vowed to, quote, end the days of cooking the books, shading the truth, and breaking our laws. Bush's speech came on the crest of a wave of corporate scandal, some of which reach as high up as the White House. The speech was intended to distance the administration from these scandals, as well as to quell the fears of jittery investors. But critics said the Bush reform plan is more rhetoric than substance, a watered-down version of Democratic proposals circulating in Congress. Wall Street also seemed unimpressed. Stocks continued to drop throughout Bush's address. Bush's address was his first major policy speech in months on a subject other than the so-called war on terror. Some key proposals of the Bush plan include doubling the maximum prison term for corporate fraud, strengthening laws that criminalize document shredding, expanding the Securities and Exchange Commission. All these proposals are either already on the books or vastly weaken current Democratic proposals. For example, the Bush proposal calls for $100 million in additional funding next year for the SEC. Senate Democrats want to add nearly $300 million. Bush suggested expanding the prison sentence for corporate fraud to 10 years. A competing Democratic proposal would bump the number up to 30. By far, the greatest emphasis of Bush's speech was on executive responsibility, not on reforming the system. We go now to an excerpt of that speech.
Yet ultimately, the ethics of American business depend on the conscience of America's business leaders. We need men and women of character who know the difference between ambition and destructive greed, between justified risk and irresponsibility, between enterprise and fraud. Our schools of business must be principled teachers of right and wrong, and not surrender to moral confusion and relativism. Our leaders of business must set high and clear expectations of conduct demonstrated by their own conduct. Responsible business leaders do not jump ship during hard times. Responsible leaders do not collect huge bonus packages when the value of their company dramatically declines. Responsible leaders do not take home tens of millions of dollars in compensation as their companies prepare to file for bankruptcy, devastating the holdings of their investors. Everyone in a company should live up to high standards, but the burden of leadership rightly belongs to the chief executive officer. CEOs set the ethical direction for their companies. They set a moral tone by the decisions they make, the respect they show their employees, and their willingness to be held accountable for their actions. They set a moral tone by showing their disapproval of other executives who bring discredit to the business world. And one of the principal ways that CEOs set an ethical tone is through their compensation. The pay package sends a clear signal whether a business leader is committed to teamwork or personal enrichment. It tells you whether his principal goal is the creation of wealth for shareholders or the accumulation of wealth for himself. The SEC currently requires the annual disclosure of a CEO's compensation, but that information is often buried in long proxy statements and seldom seen by shareholders.
President Bush speaking yesterday on Wall Street about corporate responsibility. You are listening to Democracy Now! As we turn first for comment from John Ilario. He is a former Enron employee. Welcome to Democracy Now!
Yes, good morning.
Well, your response to President Bush's speech calling for corporate responsibility.
Well, it was a lofty, good feeling speech, but I thought it was well delivered, and I think it gave Main Street some comfort. It's we're still to be seen if it's really going to be of any use. The market shrugged it off, and real reforms perhaps are not in this first phase. If there is going to be any other phases.
John, you are a former Enron manager, founder of LaidOff.com, a website that designs and sells angry anti-Enron apparel to benefit ex-Enron employees. Where do you and your colleagues stand right now?
You know, I'm not really sure I can comment too much on all of my colleagues. I think I can pretty much say is we're still in a an angry state. However, I think most of us are pushing on. I think the WorldCom folks will go through various degrees of anger and frustration and need to find a point where they just got to push on with themselves and find out that, you know, this is the brutal world of business and things move on.
In a nutshell, can you tell us what happened to most Enron employees' pension funds and the latest revelations of, even at the time when the scandal was breaking and as Enron workers were making their deals, learning that the Enron executives were making vast amounts, even in these last months?
Right. I mean, that was incredibly vexing when that's going on, and the impropriety was so egregious. I think we all walked away with an incredible bitter pill in our mouths. At this point, we're still some of us are still fighting to get just severance, and the severance that has been awarded to the majority, many think is inadequate, but they're just taking the money and running, and as I said, just kind of pushing on with their new lives.
What do you think is the kind of regulation you would like to see right now?
Well, I think that just jumps out at me is the accountability at the board of directors. I think it's a good thing that CFOs and CEOs are signing a document which puts them personally at at the forefront of responsibility of correct numbers and an income statement and balance sheet. However, I think if there is a real independent board of directors who are taking more seriously their job, perhaps that's the only thing that they do, that there'll be a more independent oversight of corporations and there'll be checks and balances. So nothing like this ever happens again.
I want to thank you, John, for being with us, former Enron manager. As we turn to Kara Alcantar, she was laid off last week after working for WorldCom for 4 years. That looks like it may be about to announce the biggest bankruptcy in U.S. history. Can you talk about your response to President Bush's speech and what you think needs to be done with companies like WorldCom, the one that has just laid you off?
Well, what needs to be done with WorldCom at this point, I think, is hopefully going to be a further investigation. When people aren't talking, it concerns me because when the executives aren't saying anything, when they're remaining quiet, I'm not sure what happens from there. And because laws aren't in place to protect the employees and to protect the people who invest in these corporations, I don't know what will happen. So I'm just sort of waiting and seeing right now and listening to our president as he makes his announcement.
What has been the effect of the layoffs on you and your fellow workers?
The effects have been no job. the morale after losing a job is it's a little discouraging when you're sent out the way we were sent out. It's depressing to lose your job and to lose an entire family and to lose faith in such a big corporation.
How surprised were you?
I wasn't that surprised. I was more shocked. But I wasn't really that surprised. There have been signs that have been leading towards this. It was it was our biggest fear and then our worst nightmare. So,
do you have confidence as George Bush speaks?
I do not have confidence in... I have confidence that there could be a change. I don't have confidence in what the president has said thus far, and that's unfortunate. I think the poll that's been taken shows a lack of confidence, and I'm hoping that'll change, and I'm hoping that he'll make some decisions, especially regarding the bill.
Kara Alcantar, I want to thank you for being with us from WorldCom Just Laid Off. When we come back from our break, we'll be joined by Charles Lewis of the Center for Public Integrity. Talk about President Bush's own record when it comes to corporate dealings. We're also going to take a look at the head of the Army and his connections to Enron, why he's still in office, and look at this suit now against Halliburton and Dick Cheney, the vice president, formerly head of Halliburton. You are listening to Democracy Now! Stay with us.
Bush and his boys have put greed back in style. They're just like junkies ripping off my abuela's purse and spending the money on missiles. We know the score. He stole the job from Gore. We've been through worse before. And we won't just lie on the floor. We know what we're working for. The bush may look solid and the ridge sitting pretty, but take a look down at our grassroots. Oh, in the suburbs, the country, and here in the city, our movements are sending up shoots. We know the score. He stole the job from Gore.
We know the score. Hail to the Thief, Songs of the Bush Years, Francisco Herrera and Bernard Gilbert. You are listening to Democracy Now!, the exception to the rulers. I'm Amy Goodman. President Bush just gave his speech on corporate responsibility, saying it's the executives and not the system that's the problem. Let's look at the chief executive himself, George Bush, and what his corporate connections have been. We go now to Charles Lewis. He is the head of the Center for Public Integrity, a nonprofit, nonpartisan research group in Washington that concentrates on ethics and public service issues, described as a watchdog in the corridors of power. Charles Lewis, the center was among the first to begin investigating George Bush's days as director of Harkin Energy. Can you talk about your response to the speech in the context of his own history?
Well, there's more than a little irony, of course, and you know, there's a slight hollow ring to some of the words about corporate responsibility. I mean, Bush was investigated by the Securities and Exchange Commission, and while they did not pursue an insider trading prosecution of him, the staff in a memo did say that he broke the law four times by not reporting promptly in the confines of the law his transactions as a board of directors member and selling $800,000 worth of stock days before it posted $23 million in losses. But also, this is a company, Harkin Energy, that he was on the board of, that, and also the audit committee a member, that, you know, was skating on the edge as a company. It had to restate its earnings. There was a phony transaction basically to hide its losses, selling a subsidiary called Aloha Petroleum, and basically trying to, as I said, cover up their millions of dollars of losses. And Bush was in the midst of all this, and there's no sign that he was offended by any of these things. Whether he didn't know about it as a board member that and an audit committee member, that's not terribly impressive. At the most charitable and worse is he may have been complicit to exactly the extent of his involvement, knowledge, participation is still frankly murky. And Bush, his own description of his activities, for example, why he didn't promptly report, he's actually given three or four different explanations over the years. And as recent as a couple days ago at his news conference said he still doesn't quite sure know what happened. And so for him to give a speech at a crucial historic moment about where we're going as a nation and corporate responsibility and the crisis of confidence in business and we must do this and this and this, there is an incredible amount of irony. And you know, let's be honest, much of what he proposed, he has mentioned here and there in recent weeks, and there was really no big surprise of many of the things he proposed and suggested. And there were a lot of things he didn't say in the speech that, you know, if you're into tenacious reform or aggressive pursuit of wrongdoers and also looking at systemic problems, which it's very clear there are substantial problems there, arguably he did not address them, honestly.
What do you think would be the most effective way to deal with this corporate crime wave that's sweeping the nation?
Well, I mean, I think to cast it still, he didn't use the phrase a few bad apples, but a lot of his proposals seem to think reflect that kind of a thinking. I think you clearly have an aggressive pursuit by the accounting industry for the last 10 years involving Democrats and Republicans to try to weaken or eliminate any oversight and major disclosure requirements of the accounting industry. There are proposals right now in Congress. No one knows where Bush stands. Bush didn't reveal in his speech where he stands, other than some vague rhetoric about, you know, the tougher standards. But there are different versions of how to do that, and he appears to be supporting the weaker self-regulation version of that at the moment, if there's any indication at all. And so I just think dealing with the systemic problems of the industry, the accounting industry, but other industries themselves, and basically the substantial deregulation that has occurred of them in recent years. And, you know, Madison said if men were angels, there'd be no need for government. And we know men and women are not angels. And clearly we've seen a spate of scandals really unparalleled in American business, I think, probably since the 30s. And it cries out for leadership by government. And the head of government, of course, is the president. We expect him to set a tone and be literally viscerally outraged by this, and I didn't really get a sense of that yesterday.
We're also joined on the phone by Tyson Slocum, Research Director of Public Citizens Critical Mass Energy and Environment Program. I'd like to move from George Bush to his Vice President Dick Cheney. Vice President Cheney and Halliburton, the oil company he ran for 5 years, are being accused of accounting fraud by the Washington-based Judicial Watch, which says it's going to file a shareholder lawsuit today against Cheney and Halliburton. Cheney, chair and chief executive of the oil field services giant from 1995 to 2000. Can you talk about Halliburton and the vice president?
Sure, Amy. I think it's important to note that Judicial Watch, this legal group that's filed this lawsuit, is a very conservative group that, in fact, helped spearhead the charges against Bill Clinton and the impeachment trial. So this is not just a liberal left-wing conspiracy against the administration. This is a principled organization that is going after the Bush and Cheney administration. As you pointed out, Amy, Dick Cheney was the CEO and chairman of the board at Halliburton Energy from 1995 until August of 2000. And during his tenure, the company pursued some very aggressive accounting techniques, and Halliburton's accountant during Cheney's tenure was Arthur Andersen. And what they did, beginning in 98, Halliburton had a construction subsidiary that was experiencing significant cost overruns due to its own problems. So its construction projects were a lot more expensive than Halliburton said they were going to be. So Halliburton, instead of booking those cost overruns as expenses, booked those cost overruns as revenues, assuming that their clients would be paying for the cost overruns. So that inflated Halliburton's bottom line by about $100 million, which had a significant impact on the company's profitability. And, of course, Dick Cheney was making millions of dollars in bonuses that were tied to the to Halliburton's stock performance, and he cashed out tens of millions of dollars in stock options that were directly tied to the company's share price. The thing about it is that Cheney and the other top executives waited a year before informing the Securities and Exchange Commission and its own shareholders of this accounting change. So the Securities and Exchange Commission announced in May that they were initiating an investigation against Halliburton. Well, Public Citizen has called for an independent prosecutor because we are not confident that the Securities and Exchange Commission, which is run by a Bush-Cheney appointee, is at all going to be serious about investigating the vice president. And this really takes us back to Bush's speech last night, where he really focused on just going after a couple of bad apples, a couple of bad executives. And he called for increasing penalties against people who are convicted of crimes. Well, the problem is, as we've seen with Enron and WorldCom, Amy, is that so much of what these executives did was perfectly legal, and it's not punishable by a law, and so therefore increasing penalties against crimes that don't even exist is not going to be at all effective at protecting workers and your average citizen. What we need is an aggressive regulatory response against a systemic problem, a culture of corporate greed. We need to aggressively go after the accounting industry. Harvey Pitt should resign as Securities and Exchange Commission chairman because he personally has been the chief lobbyist blocking reform attempts over the past decade that would have helped stop a lot of these accounting scandals that are going on right now.
Can you explain that and what the role of the SEC, the Securities and Exchange Commission, is and where Harvey Pitt comes from?
Sure, Amy. The SEC was formed during the Great Depression in response to America's last great stock market and corporate scandal in 1929. And what the Securities and Exchange Commission is designed to do is to protect investors who are making good faith investments in a publicly traded company. And the Securities and Exchange Commission forces these companies to disclose important information about the company's business so that everybody can know what a company is up to and how it's performing. It's a very, very important regulatory agency. Harvey Pitt became a multimillionaire over a 20-year career defending people accused of white-collar crimes. He was a white-collar defense attorney, and he was also a key lobbyist for the accounting industry. He made his name very early on in the 1980s defending Ivan Boesky. And so there were numerous reforms that the Clinton administration's Securities and Exchange Commission had proposed that were very, very good reforms. One of them would have eliminated the ability of an accounting firm like Arthur Andersen to provide both auditing and consulting services to its client. For example, Arthur Andersen was providing auditing and consulting services to Halliburton while Cheney was there. And according to SEC documents, Halliburton was paying $19 million to Arthur Andersen for consulting services, like helping. So Arthur Andersen was assisting Halliburton in coming up with ways to, it's very possible that Arthur Andersen helped Halliburton devise this accounting scheme whereby Halliburton was allowed to claim this $100 million bonus against its liability. Harvey Pitt was the lead lobbyist in blocking this reform effort that would have eliminated this conflict of interest. Another thing that Harvey Pitt worked very hard on was the 1995 Securities Litigation Reform Act, which would have made it a lot easier for shareholders to sue fraudulent accountants and fraudulent CEOs. That law was passed over Clinton's veto, and Harvey Pitt was regarded as one of the main lobbyists who helped get that bill through. So that shielded a lot of top executives and corrupt accountants from the type of civil litigation that Judicial Watch is pursuing right now against Cheney and Halliburton.
It looks like there's a growing movement to get rid of Harvey Pitt. I mean, let's not forget the cabinet of President Bush has the highest concentration of corporate executives in the history. Is that right?
Oh, absolutely. And another one that we've definitely been looking at is Thomas White, who is Bush's Secretary of the Army. We have called for Thomas White's resignation months ago because of his role in the California energy crisis as a top Enron executive.
Can you explain that further?
Sure. Up until the day that Thomas White was nominated to be the head of the Secretary of the Army in May of 2001 by George Bush, he had been an 11-year executive at Enron, where he headed up a division called Enron Energy Services. That division is directly implicated in some internal Enron memos that were released to the public a couple months ago in some of the most damaging manipulation strategies that caused the California energy crisis. Specifically, what Thomas White's division was doing was lying to California authorities, telling them that they had to move far more power than they actually needed in order to get all sorts of lucrative fees, payment fees, in order not to move this power. This strategy intentionally clogged up transmission capacity and made California think that they couldn't get power to where it needed to go. This manipulation strategy directly resulted in rolling blackouts, in intentional power outages to the state, and it made Enron tens of millions of dollars. Thomas White was the head of this division. I don't know if he personally approved of or knew of these manipulation strategies, but it is very clear that he profited off of it. Just like Cheney at Halliburton, Thomas White, Bush's Secretary of the Army, made tens of millions of dollars off of Enron's share price because of Enron's fraudulent practices at Enron boosted its bottom line. And it is amazing to us at Public Citizen that Thomas White still has a job. He is not fit to hold a public office. It is very clear that Enron deliberately caused an energy crisis in California, and Secretary Thomas White is a very rich man because of that manipulation and fraud, and he should be held accountable.
And how far is the investigation into him gone? We have heard his name raised several times.
There is no investigation into Thomas White. The administration has no investigation into him, and in fact, George Bush has said publicly that he stands behind Thomas White 100%. And that's part of the problem here, Amy, is that we have no true investigations into these corporate criminals. The Securities and Exchange Commission has said that they're investigating Halliburton. Well, 2 months after that investigation has started, they haven't even contacted Dick Cheney yet. Dick Cheney was the CEO who was in charge of these accounting problems at Halliburton. They haven't even contacted him yet. And even if they do, are Americans really going to be satisfied with the result of an investigation by Bush and Cheney's SEC into their own investigation, into their own actions? Clearly what is needed here is some form of an independent prosecutor in order to guarantee that that justice will be done.
Tyson Slocum, what about Bush's call for the creation of a financial crimes SWAT team?
Well, that's very interesting. He has nominated Larry Thompson, who is currently a deputy attorney general under John Ashcroft, to head this corporate fraud division. Larry Thompson, before he became or before he got appointed to the attorney general's office, was a defense attorney representing white-collar criminals. And Larry Thompson has also been heading up the attorney general's Enron criminal task force, which has resulted in zero arrests so far as I can tell. So I do not have a lot of faith in yet another Bush administration fraud task force that has resulted in no arrests so far. And I really think it's another toothless proposal. You know, as they say in Texas, I think a lot of Bush's proposals are all hat and no cattle. He's come out very strong saying he's going to hold executives accountable, but he's not willing to change the regulatory framework, the deregulation that has caused all of these corporate scandals. He's not willing to take that on. And so far, the Democrats in the Senate have proposed legislation that would start to take us on the road towards corporate accountability, providing independent oversight of the accounting industry, forcing accountants to give up their lucrative consulting contracts and get back to what they should be doing, which is auditing public companies to provide for the public trust.
Tyson Slocum, I want to thank you for being with us of Public Citizen, Charles Lewis of the Center for Public Integrity. When we come back, a few quick questions for Charles Derber, author of Corporation Nation. How bad is the situation right now compared to corporate power through history in the United States? And then we're going to Barcelona, Spain, to the International AIDS Conference to find out what happened to Tommy Thompson as he tried to deliver a speech. Stay with us.
In a time of secret wooing, today prepares tomorrow's ruin. Left knows not what right is doing. My heart is torn asunder. In a time of furtive sighs, sweet hellos and sad goodbyes, half truths told and entire lies, my conscience echoes thunder. In a time when kingdoms come, joy is brief as summer's fun. Happiness, its race has run. Then pain stalks in to plunder.
Maya Angelou in a time mixed with Sending the Groove Collective here on Democracy Now! Breaking the Sound Barrier. I'm Amy Goodman as we turn now to Charles Derber, professor of sociology at Boston College. He's author of Corporation Nation. How bad is the Bush presidency when we put it in the context of U.S. history and corporate power?
It's right up there. I'm not sure there is a historical period that is so unbalanced in terms of the tilt between financial and, you know, democratic kinds of power. The three periods, Amy, that I think of as relevant to this whole scandal are the 1880s and 90s, which is, of course, the Gilded Age of the robber barons, the Rockefellers and Morgans and Carnegies and so forth, where you had an enormous surge of blatant corporate the formation of the modern corporation, the takeover of government in a very blatant way by large businesses and financial institutions, financial speculation and scandals. That led to the Progressive Era and some modest reforms, regulatory reforms. Teddy Roosevelt, who Bush is sometimes ridiculously compared to, was fairly serious about trying to get certain major antitrust, anti-monopoly reforms passed, but most of it actually helped stabilize the system and allow big business to grow further. This was followed by the 1920s, another very substantial period of corporate expansion. Three Republican presidents who were all basically servants of the corporate elites, a lot of financial scandals like the Teapot Dome scandal and so forth, and a lot of financial speculation again, leading to the 29 crash, and then the movement toward another kind of systemic shift during the New Deal. And then the period starting in the 1980s, which I think we're at the culminating phase of now, which started with Reagan and Bush Sr. and through Clinton, who was very much like Grover Cleveland, the only Democrat during the Gilded Age who was very much a pro-business president. So I think we've seen these three eras all characterized pretty much by the same fundamental problem, which was the the rise of enormous corporate power and the collapse of countervailing forces, labor unions, governments that could, you know, stand up to this power and try to hold it accountable. I should say that I also think that the critical historical dynamic through this whole last 150 years or so since the Civil War has been to essentially undermine the whole idea of accountability to the public, the whole concept of what a corporation is. Prior to the Civil War, people don't know this history very much, but it's an amazing history, the corporation was treated as a public enterprise. That is, it was not seen as private. It was not seen as set up by private parties to make profit. It was conceived as a state creation, subject to popular control to serve the public interest. This was written in the original charters. And there was a great deal of direct accountability of the public to the public because Jefferson and a lot of the early American founders were very, very apprehensive about the concentration of financial and corporate power. Since the Civil War, and Abraham Lincoln actually predicted this, the Constitution has been rewritten several times, and much corporate law and chartering law has been reconstructed to essentially create a shield around the corporation, to essentially define it as private with constitutional rights of privacy and free speech, that shielded from the kind of public accountability that corporations were set up with in the Republic at the very beginning. So I see this whole thing as kind of the culmination of a long period of constitutional change reflecting power shifts in the larger society that has essentially stripped away the ability of ordinary people to learn about and assert legal constitutional forms of control over business. So I think the solution to this problem is way beyond the issues of regulation that you're hearing, you know, even the Senate Sarbanes-Bill and so forth talk about, and particularly the whole concept that empowering investors is the solution to this problem is really going to derail us, because even though investors have been defrauded in this situation, in some sense the whole situation reflects the rise of a shareholder value movement that has essentially prioritized stock prices and shareholder value at the expense of all the other public interests that corporations ought to be serving. So my argument would be that, you know, if you look at this in the long historical perspective, it's a logical culmination of a tremendous growth of corporate power, the captivation of governments by power, the sort of privatization of the corporation from the public entity that it was once conceived of legally, and that this is a fertile moment to essentially challenge that history in a sort of popular education movement. Really, it's really an issue of democracy. Essentially raising very fundamental questions about what a corporation is, what its constitutional standing is, what the role of the people is in governing and shaping the charters and missions of corporations. It's really it's one of those, you know, potential tipping points in history when we have one of those rare opportunities to change the public debate in a fairly significant way.
If people want to find out more about the corporate responsibility movement that you're talking about, or the overall reshaping of corporations in this country, where could you suggest they go on the web?
Well, I think, you know, Public Citizen, you just had a really good speaker from Public Citizen, which does a lot along with the Nader groups on these issues. So that website is very useful. In the back of Corporation Nation, the book you referred to, I refer to a lot of websites and organizations. I think the issues related to campaign finance reform are relevant here. The POCLAD groups that are dealing with charter reform on the local level, there's a tremendous number of grassroots groups around the country that are essentially pro-democracy groups. A lot of them got a lot of momentum during the globalization struggles that are still going on, and So there's just a lot of organizations and a lot of information out there.
Well, I want to thank you very much for being with us, Charles Derber, author of Corporation Nation and professor of sociology at Boston College. As we take a trip across the Atlantic, protesters stormed the stage and shouted down U.S. Secretary of Health and Human Services Tommy Thompson as he spoke at the 14th International AIDS Conference yesterday. This is the AIDS Conference heard alarming new forecasts. One study predicted HIV infections among the young could soar by more than 70% by the end of the decade. Black women in this country, particularly hard hit. 95% of HIV infections are in the developing world, where access to new antiretroviral drugs is extremely limited. Only 0.1% of the people infected with HIV in sub-Saharan Africa have access to modern drugs. On the first day of the AIDS conference, the World Health Organization announced it must reach 3 million people in the developing countries with antiretroviral treatments by 2005. But activists at the conference insist if this goal is to be met, the U.S. has to commit to fighting AIDS. Yesterday, activists told Tommy Thompson to stop preventing other countries from trying to produce generic drugs and to supply adequate funds to the UN Global Fund to fight AIDS. The fund needs $10 billion each year. In his speech, Thompson said the United States, quote, is leading the world in its support for the fund by committing $500 million, but most of his words were drowned out by the protesters. We're going to go now to hear some of the commotion yesterday in Barcelona, recorded by Davey D of KPFA's Hard Knock Radio.
We need action from governments, especially the U.S. government. We need leadership and not empty promises. We need Tommy Thompson's actions to match his words. And what we're demanding is billions for the Global Fund to fight AIDS, tuberculosis, and malaria. And we'll get into a little bit of detail about how the U.S. government
Asia Russell of ACTA
sabotaged an effort to get money to fund treatment to save lives this year and effectively sabotaged that while in the same breath claimed that it was doing the most and being the most compassionate that any administration had ever been anywhere in the world. Clearly today the message was Tommy Thompson is lying to the community at large, and we're here to tell the true story. For anyone who wasn't at the action, activists took over his presentation and were joined and supported in solidarity by people in the audience packing the room. He was the first speaker, and activists chanted as they got up onto the stage and had a megaphone and banners and took over the stage and actually refused to allow Tommy Thompson to speak, because the truth is we know what he was going to say and we're tired of his lies. And people here needed to listen to what the truth is, that he's been denying funds and other life-saving resources to the communities in the United States and around the world who need them desperately to hold on and to save themselves and their families. And it's unacceptable, and we need change from the U.S. administration now. The next speaker is Zipho Ntati from the Treatment Action Campaign in South Africa.
Okay, thank you. Last year, when September 11 happened, I think many of us in South Africa and I think in the rest of the world cried. We cried because of the loss of lives that had happened in the U.S. But many of us in Africa, and particularly in South Africa, we cried for the millions of lives that die, that are lost every day to HIV and AIDS in our country. We cried for our family members and our relatives that we lose each and every day in our country. We heard after September 11 that the U.S. had managed to mobilize within a day, within a matter of a few days, $14 billion to fight the war against terrorism and to support companies that had suffered through the Terrorist Act. But when the U.S. is given a chance through the Global Fund to contribute in the fight, in the terrorism, in the fight against the terrorism of AIDS, that has killed more than 200,000 South Africans and more than 5 million Africans and other people in developing countries, the U.S. says we do not have resources. And this makes us raise questions about the U.S.'s commitment to humanity and about the U.S.'s true intentions. The U.S. not only has the influence in the world, but it has the resources to give to the Global Fund to mobilize other developed countries to give to the Global Fund to help developing countries to save 3 million lives that are lost in every year in their country. We ask the U.S. today to not only to give the billions that as people living with HIV and as people in the rest of the developing world know that it has, but to mobilize world support for the Global Fund. We do not accept the U.S.'s excuse that it does not have resources. We do not accept the U.S.'s excuse that it is not the only country that should fight HIV and AIDS. Because we know that the U.S. has enough influence and has enough money to save, to raise the $10 billion that are needed to save lives in the developing world. We have heard in this conference, throughout this conference, that countries, developing countries with minimal resources, are implementing small programs in attempts to try and save lives of its people. And we have also heard that these countries, as poor as they are, they want to scale up these programs to save even more lives. But they are not able to do it because countries with millions, with billions of dollars, trillions of dollars like the U.S. and the rest of the developed world say they do not have resources to help Africa and to help Eastern Europe and other developing countries to save lives of its people. We do not accept this, and we demand from the U.S. government to give billions to the Global Fund, but to also mobilize with the same amount of energy and tenacity that it used to mobilize the world governments against terrorism, to mobilize the world to give to the Global Fund.
Sifa Mathati, Education Coordinator of the Treatment Action Campaign of South Africa, speaking at the news conference after the protests in Barcelona, Spain yesterday, of the speech of the head of the Department of Health and Human Services, Tommy Thompson, joining us on the line from Barcelona right now is Mandela Matona, also of the Treatment Action Campaign. You're at a protest right now of AIDS activists targeting Coca-Cola, the largest employer in sub-Saharan Africa. Why Coke?
The reason why you are targeting Coke with different NGOs here in the conference is simply because Coke is refusing to treat workers in Africa who are having HIV. Those workers are employed by Coke. Coke is saying they are not employed by her. So it is up to us to stand up and to fight this exploitation and this discrimination.
Coke doesn't provide medical coverage for AIDS-infected workers?
Coke does provide medical scheme for workers, and Coke includes treatment for the developed countries, but for Africa, That is not included. That is antiretrovirals for workers who are living with HIV. Hence, today we decided to fight Coke and to demand that they should not neglect Africa and their workers in Africa. They must provide treatment for workers in Africa who are employed by Coke.
Well, Mandela Matona, I want to thank you for being with us for this brief moment from Barcelona, Spain, of the Treatment Action Campaign of South Africa, which rounds out our hour on corporate responsibility. If you would like to get a cassette copy of today's program, you can call 1-800-735-0230. That's 1-800-735-0230. You can go to our website for contact information, www.democracynow.org. That's www.democracynow.org. Democracy Now! Is produced by Chris Abrams, Miranda Kennedy, Lizzie Ratner, Michael Ye. Anthony Sloan is our music maestro and engineer. You can email us at mail, M-A-I-L, at democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for listening to another edition of Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! As you go out with a couple of friends by Holly Near.
That we have created from love, from a life.